Penguin Audio presents Paddle Your Own Canoe, One Man's Fundamentals for Delicious Living, written and read by me, Nick Offerman. To Megan, my wife, cherry blossom, and legal property, who teaches me life every day, and to her mother, Martha, who has taught us both beauty and humor. She also taught Megan a class, but got to me too late. A gentleman is someone who can play the accordion, but doesn't. Tom Waits. Foreplay. I am a jackass living in America, and living surprisingly well. Let's make that our jumping-off point. I come by it honest. I am your average meat, potatoes, and corn-fed human male with a propensity for smartassery who has managed to make a rewarding vocation out of essentially making funny faces and falling down. I have also exhibited some tool skills and an inclination for eating delicious meat stuffs, and have then been somehow rewarded quite overhandsomely for these tendencies. I grew up literally in the middle of a cornfield in the village of Manuka, Illinois, where I spent a lot of time learning to use intoxicants, chasing girls, screwing around in the woods, mostly without the girls, and serving under Father Tony, unmolested, at our local Catholic church, St. Mary's. I learned the word nonconformist in fourth grade and immediately announced that I would grow up to become one. I have a hell of a great family in Illinois, and now some more in Oklahoma via my wife Megan. I have spent the vast majority of my adult life working as an actor, and also to a lesser extent as a woodworker. I'm going to run on at some length about the excellent people whom I have called friends, and some others whom I have had the privilege of calling teachers, and while those parts are all well and good, there will also be some dirty parts, and I believe cunnilingus gets at least two mentions. Favorable. On top of all that, and woven all throughout it, I'll describe my wife, who is just a goddamn blessing to me in a great many ways, enriching my life to such an extent that I can go nowhere anymore without passers-by muttering, "There goes that lucky bastard." I can only make a dimple and solemnly nod in agreement. Each story comes with a delicious fundamental, advice about living life that I hope you'll find useful. Of course, my fundamentals may not work for everyone. A beautiful aspect of the human race is our endless variety. Like maple leaves and snowflakes, there are no two of us alike. Therefore, while my tactics involving the cultivation of lush facial hair and the consumption of pork products as well as those derived from beef may not be exactly the steps of the path you might tread on your own way to delicious living, perhaps my techniques will at least inspire you to forge your own discipline, providing you with the necessary skills to blaze your own trail. Basically, this book boils down to how an average human dipshit like myself, relying solely on warped individuality and a little elbow grease, can actually rise from a simple life of relative poverty to one of prosperity. Measured in American dollars and Italian bandsaws, sure, but more importantly, laughter, wood shavings, and kisses. The key lies in finding the delicious flavorings in one's own life, no matter how fancy your blue jeans may or may not be. The notions herein are meant to inform, inspire, and engender mirth. Enjoy, please and thank you. Chapter 1. Not So Little House on the Prairie. Jesus, Mary, and Joseph. Where do I begin chapter 1? I suppose we'll do a chronological thing and start you off with some of the early years, a taste of the vintage stuff. I showed up on Earth in the Tri-County area of Illinois, to be more precise, in 1970. This was reportedly the year Tom Waits showed up in L.A. to start pushing his demos around town. I haven't had the chance to ask Tom if he was trying to send me a personal message of serendipity with his beautiful and haunting songs of the day like Grapefruit Moon and Midnight Lullaby, but it seems too crazy on the nose to be just coincidence, right? Somewhere in the Arizona desert, Tom Laughlin was shooting the movie Billy Jack, and Warlock-style wax albums were dropping all about the realm with names like Look a Pie Pie, Black Sabbath, Sex Machine, Moondance, Bitches Brew, The Man Who Sold the World, After the Gold Rush, Free Your Mind and Your Ass Will Follow, Christofferson, for crying out loud, Let It Be, and the most weirdly Kabbalistic, Randy Newman's 12 Songs. Potent magics coalesced and fluctuated across the void, whilst strange nether clouds swelled with great portent above the green crop fields awaiting, what, some child? A chosen man-cub? Despite some loose popular misconceptions, I did not, in fact, drop from my mother's womb wielding a full mustache and a two-headed battle axe, nor was there cited evidence of even the first follicle of the first hair of my chest bracken. Those laurels would come later. The luckiest part of my very lucky life, pre-Megan, has been being raised by my family in the environment they created for the rearing of my siblings and me. My mom, Catherine Ann Offerman, nay Roberts, and my dad, Frederick Dames Offerman, grew up about 3 miles from each other in the middle of the countryside outside of Manuka, Illinois. Where is that? Right next to Shanahan, as I like to quip. I told you this shit was going to be humorous. Southwest of Joliet. My mom grew up in a family of 4 kids, born to Mike and Eloise Roberts, and they raised pigs, soybeans, and corn. My dad, born to Raymond Offerman and Marilyn Dames Offerman, grew up on a dairy farm with 2 siblings before moving into town as a teenager. They all attended the same Manuka schools that I eventually did and married young. Dad was 24 and Mom was 19, which seems batshit crazy to me these days. Manuka is, surprisingly, only about an hour from Lakeshore Drive in Chicago if there's no traffic. But it seems like it's 50 years distant, or at least it did in my youth. It was very bucolic and idyllic, like American Graffiti or Happy Days. Saturday night meant you'd get together and buzz the gut in your jalopy, which meant drive past the 5 businesses on Main Street. At the time I was growing up, the population was 768. It's grown ridiculously. It's up near 12,000 now. It used to be primarily a farming community, but by now the commuting suburban population has reached it and subsumed it. There are now many inhabitants of Manuka whom I would consider soft, and yes, that is a judgment. My dad went to Illinois State University. I had always heard various legends of his prowess as an athlete as a young man, primarily in baseball and basketball. I wrote to him, asking for some facts on this subject for my book, because he's always been pretty humble about it to the point of being mum. And here's an excerpt of his reply. Well, I don't know what you heard, but remember it was a very small high school. In baseball, I started every varsity game for 4 years, except one as a freshman, and in that one I pinch hit and hit a triple. Then later in that game I hit another triple. That never happened again. As a sophomore, I batted 2nd, 3rd as a junior, and 4th as a senior, and was the shortstop the last 3 years. I hit .333, 22 for 66, and led the team in RBIs. That was 2nd to your Uncle Mark, who hit 1,000, 1 for 1. I never considered myself as a terrific player, but I had one damn burning desire to play and was surprised many times when I did well. This might begin to give you an idea of from whence I sprung. They have yet to make a man I like better or respect more than my dad, and he'll be the first to tell you that my mom is even better. They married young, and my mother had my older sister, Lori, when she was 20. 20! The balls on these people. They rented an old farm for $100 a month plus utilities. It was right in between the 2 farms they grew up on, and that's where I lived for my first 5 years. Looking back on it now, I am just astonished at how little income we got by on. The older I get, the more my parents just seem like absolute heroes to me. My dad was teaching junior high geography, history, and social studies in Shanahan, as well as tacking on every bit of extra income that he could squeeze in. He drove a school bus, he coached basketball, and in the summer break he would work on a local blacktop crew or earn wages on the Roberts farm, where my mom grew up. Meanwhile, my mom was running a household with 4 children, making a lot of our clothes and cooking up a storm, not too far off from Ma and Pa Ingalls. They raised us 4 kids, Lori, me, Carrie, and Matt, the baby, also known as Matt Mailman, as solid as Illinois livestock. My sisters and brother are the cut of folk who I'd be damn glad to stand beside in a bar brawl, a square dance, or a pie-eating competition, and preferably the latter. It was an old farmhouse and drafty, so we nailed blankets over the doors to combat the drafts. We had our first big garden there, and I have the most wonderful memories of my parents' gardens. To this day, my dad has two huge gardens, one at home and one out at the Roberts Farm. One of my earliest memories is of sitting in the garden in the strawberry patch in my diaper, probably fertilizing the strawberries more than I'd care to admit, ironically happy as a pig in shit, just sitting in the mud and eating strawberries. We were right across the road from the Auxable Creek, which is the creek that ran through my life. No matter where my mom's family was farming or where we lived, we were always within a few miles of the creek. That's where I learned to fish and eventually canoe. My first job on the farm was shoveling pig shit in the barn basement for my grandpa Mike Roberts. He probably paid me a nickel for lending him a hand in procedures of animal husbandry. One of my most distinct memories as a small boy was handing my grandfather the one-year-old pigs, which he would then sequester upside down in this clamped bracket so that he could handily cut their nuts out with a razor knife and then spray the wound with a medicinal purple spray. You may begin to understand why this memory is particularly poignant, for I promise you've never heard anyone scream like a one-year-old pig screaming for its balls. It was never so Little House on the Prairie that we'd have our own pig-killing day. It was something I always loved reading about, though. The whole neighborhood had come out together, as I've read in Little House on the Prairie, and also in the fiction of Wendell Berry, our nation's most venerated living agrarian author, and far and away my personal favorite writer. He has a great short story, Don't Send a Boy to Do a Man's Work, where somebody uninvited shows up with some whiskey, and it turns into a very messy hog slaughter day. We were eventually aware that a couple of Grandpa's pigs would come home from market and go straight into the freezer. As kids, we'd have our favorite pigs and we'd name them. There were a few gray years before we realized this bacon used to be old Fat Albert. As the oldest male grandchild, I suppose the guys were trying me out at different tasks to see if I would take to farming. I remember a time when there was a pig who died of an intestinal sickness, and a vet came out and removed its intestines to determine what it had. My uncle Don Roberts and I took the pig on the end loader, which is a tractor with a bucket on the front, out into a field and buried the pig and the intestines separately. This may be revisionist history, but I recall that pile of guts being the same purple as the neuter spray. That color purple was ruined for me. I was later a big fan of Prince, but his greatest album unfortunately gave me visions less redolent of Apollonia's beauty and more suited to the abattoir. On that day in the field, I remember Uncle Don explaining that you had to bury both deep enough and cover them with rocks so the coyotes wouldn't dig them up. Out in the hog lot, there were big round feeder bins into a top central hatch of which one would dump hog feed. The pigs would then access the feed off the chutes at the bottom, which was handy for them, but unfortunately it was also handy for the rats, which are always a big problem on a farm. So when the rats got bad enough, Grandpa and the uncles would hoist this feeder up in the air with the same bucket loader. We would assemble a whole neighborhood of friends who would surround the feeder. There'd be 20 neighborhood men and boys armed with pitchforks, spades, and hoes. They'd have half as many dogs standing at the ready. And when the feeder took to the air, maybe 100 rats would scatter in every direction. Many would elude the weapons, but I don't believe a rat ever escaped the dogs. Those pooches had a field day. It was really quite something. There were lessons of life and death pretty much from the get-go on Grandpa's farm. Hilarious book, right, people? When I was 5, my dad had an opportunity that seemed very Little House on the Prairie to me. There was a farmer named Bob Hart who was going to tear down his old two-story farmhouse and build a newfangled single-story ranch house. He offered my family his old house if we could simply roll the house on wheels to a new 3-acre plot of land in one of his cornfields. In exchange, Bob Hart would receive a new heater in his expert machinist tractor shop, new cabinets for his wife's kitchen, the filling in of the old basement hole, and compensation for the 3 acres. Still, it was a great deal. My folks borrowed $27,000 and spent most of the $10,000 they had in savings. My dad still says it's one of the best financial moves he's ever made. Until this book, I had never put together my own penchant for moving audacious loads of scenery or tree slabs with my dad's Paul Bunyan-esque relocation of a gargantuan two-story farmhouse. I could write a whole book on the lessons I received from my dad and Uncles Dan and Don and Grandpa Mike, as well as Grandpa Ray, my dad's dad. I learned early to respect my tools and my machinery, knowing that with the proper lashing down and utilization of simple machines, the wheel, the lever, the screw, the inclined plane, there was no job of work that could defeat us. Over and over, for years, I would accompany them in tasks of carpentry and mechanics, and they would set me to work with a hammer and nails and patiently repeat, "Hit it! Don't make love to it, hit it! Hit the goddang thing!" After years of attempts, I was finally able to feel the strength come into my arms and shoulders and operate a tool in a manner that they would pronounce satisfactory. For one of those impossibly proficient men to deem my work a nice job filled me with more satisfaction than any A-plus grade I ever received in school. In my burgeoning competence with a ratchet, and more importantly, their approbation thereof, there was a complicit understanding that I was on the right path to one day have the ability to use tools to my creative benefit, just as they did every day. My mother has two brothers and one sister. My Uncle Don is the baby of the family. Later, I was astonished to realize that he is young enough to have been my older brother. He was so great with us. All my aunts and uncles were like the super friends to me, but Uncle Don was Aquaman, the coolest. My mom's younger sister, Michelle, whom we called Aunt Mickey, she was more mature and studious, as well as being fun, like when she used to name our freckles for us. She's a librarian, historian, and Manuka now, and my older sister, Lori, works with her. Aunt Mickey turned me on to the Chronicles of Narnia books, the Lord of the Rings trilogy, the Madeleine L'Engle books. I can't give her enough props, as the kids are saying, for turning me on to such great fiction. My brother and sisters didn't like reading in the same way. They eventually caught on. And Little House on the Prairie. I got so turned on by a series of books set in an alternative world. I wanted to know everything about the world. What has Pa got in his pockets? Uncle Don was the tangible version of that notion. I don't know how it came to happen, but he bought this little motorcycle and left it at our house. I think it was just generosity, knowing we couldn't afford to get something like that for ourselves. My mom's oldest brother, Uncle Dan, and his wife, Dee, became the overseers of the farm as my grandparents grew older. They had a boy and a girl, Ryan and Angie. Ryan is 6 months younger than me, so we grew up like brothers. They had the resources of the farm at their disposal, so Ryan had a go-kart and a snowmobile. But I couldn't afford that stuff, which could have been why Uncle Don left the motorcycle at my house. Uncle Don was just fun. He was and is really funny. He went to college and studied mechanical engineering, motors, basically. He worked for a while in town as the bus mechanic for the school, but I think he and Uncle Dan were both destined to stick on the farm. Their knowledge is just amazing. To be a successful farmer, you have to be a high-end mechanic, a botanist, and a soil engineer. You have to be a carpenter. Uncle Don was an incredible student of life, but also loved to have fun. He was so free-handed. He would take us with him on snowmobiling trips and motorcycle rides, or we'd just go ride bicycles. Our family loves to fish, so we'd go boating. We've always had some version of our own boats, and now everybody's got his or her own getaway cabin in Indiana or Wisconsin or Minnesota. Uncle Don had the most throbbing boner of a vehicle you could have in 1978, the Pontiac Firebird with the Phoenix on the hood and the T-top. It was so badass. He would take us for a treat to Shorewood, the near suburb of Joliet, to the Tasty Freeze to get ice cream. I'd get a vanilla cone dipped in cherry, whatever that cherry candy shit is, it's the greatest, and he'd play Frank Zappa, which was forbidden. We had a very decent household. We weren't allowed to watch The Three Stooges. Our TV was governed pretty closely. There was a ban for a while on Tom and Jerry, but eventually that was lifted. My parents didn't want their kids to see things with violence in them, which is so hilarious and sad now, looking at you video games where one can chop the heads off prostitutes. Which is my own surmise, I don't know if that actually exists, but I'm pretty sure you can find it. So, something like Frank Zappa singing Don't Eat the Yellow Snow, and having to puzzle out the meaning of that was an early awakening of the notion, I like that use of language. My neighbor Steve Rapkin lived next door on another 3-acre parcel. His parents were slightly more licentious, and he was allowed to have things like Kiss and Eddie Murphy records. My folks did not know that we would hole up in his bedroom and listen to Eddie Murphy over and over. We'd lie back on the floor, and as I've now damn near gotten into a stand-up career of my own, I think how astonishing it was to me that someone like Eddie Murphy could talk hilariously about eating pussy in public and get paid for it. The amazing thing is, it sparked something in me that remained an ember for a couple of decades. It never occurred to me that humor was remotely something I could aspire to. By the age of 8 or 9, it began to dawn on me that I wasn't exactly like the other kids in Manuka. I remember my 4th grade classroom well. I had Miss Christensen, one of many top-drawer teachers in our school. She was just an admirable woman, with whom everybody was in love, of course. 4th grade was a big reading year, and there was a contest called Battle of the Books, for which we would read titles like Caddy Woodlawn, My Side of the Mountain, and Island of the Blue Dolphins, and then compete by answering questions about the subject matter. We were learning the rudiments of plot, theme, and vocabulary, and one of our vocabulary words was nonconformist. I just dug that word. I heard the explanation, the definition, and I felt like I had just learned about a new hero in a kick-ass Marvel comic book. I raised my hand and I said, "Nonconformist, that is what I would like to be." This was met with a bemused smile by Miss Christensen, who was probably already aware of my status as a creative thinker, but couldn't have imagined how far I'd take the execution. It didn't take me long to discern that I had essentially announced to the world, "Excuse me, everyone, I am a weirdo." But no matter, the die had been cast. I also recall a moment in 2nd grade art class. We were given a piece of wood and a little paper cutout of a clown head. The assignment was to finish the wood with stain, then glue the clown head to the wood after coloring it in with crayons, then varnish the whole shebang. I adorned my clown head with color and glued it on with the clown's head cocked to the right. My teacher gave me a C. I said, "What the fuck are you talking about? This is so much better than what the rest of these squares made." And she said, "You glued it on quite crookedly." I replied, "He's got his head tilted at a rakish angle, asshole." I remember thinking, "You don't fucking get me. This is my art. This is my shit." I recall being outraged, thinking, "I don't understand. Don't you realize mine is uniquely creative and therefore way better than these other dipshits?" I simply knew that I was peculiar and that I was a puzzle to those around me. I was also learning that this weirdness was a part of me that was not to be extinguished. But for the time being, Manuka and the family farm were all that I needed. In the summers, when we would get together for family picnics, we would have enough people to field 2 teams of 10 and play softball out in the meadow. I was charmed that half of the participants would have their beers out in the field. You'd have old people saying, "I'll go out and play right field, I can't do much." It's something that's unfathomable today, to even suggest to the teenagers or anybody now, "Let's go play a sport." They'd say, "Are you crazy? We're watching the football game," or, "We're playing our Wii." All we needed back then was a bat and a ball, and I guess a beer. We would amuse ourselves with what we had on hand. After dinner, we would get on the hay rack, and everybody would ride around and look at the crops. It was a recreational ride, sitting on hay bales, singing songs. It was so heartwarming, and all it cost was the price of the fuel. We didn't have to do anything to have a good time. It's an incredible gift to be able to make your own fun. Eat red meat. Unless you're an ignorant fool, creationist, you'll have noticed that a great deal of attention is being paid to humankind's evolution over the millennia, especially with regard to our diet. According to science and smart anthropology types, our particular mammalian species evolved into sentient bipeds who learned to develop and then employ tools to further the domestic comfort of their caves. We then learned to advertise and sell these implements to one another. The progression is easy to track: the hammer, the spearhead, the fly swatter, the clapper, the Xbox, the perfusion catheter. As we human folk learned to kill and eat other animals, we came into a period of social development that I would liken to the quickening of Highlander fame. The added proteins in our diet turned us into physical specimens the likes of Sigourney Weaver, Schwarzenegger, and at the very least Ringo Starr. In short order, with knives of obsidian, a brief fad, and then sharpened steel, we learned to butcher animals in such a way as to garner the tastiest portions of their musculature or meat for eating. Then we learned to cook those muscle scraps over an open flame. Then we learned to apply sprigs of rosemary and thyme to the offerings. We learned to rub our seasonings into the flesh. Then we added garlic and butter to mashed potatoes. And then we invented barbecue sauce. And that creation, gentle listener, finally seems worthy of a restful seventh day. If there is a God, no part of the Bible or Christian doctrine will convince me of his existence half as much as the flavor of a barbecued pork rib. It is in that juicy snack that I can perhaps begin to glean a divine design, because that shit is delicious in a manner that can be accurately described as heavenly. I have never had need of a firearm in my life, not remotely, but I'll happily sport a bumper sticker that reads, "You can have my ribeye when you pry it from my cold dead fingers," or even write a bit of poetry, such as, "The bratwurst, a haiku. Tight skin, flute of pork. Juices fly, explode in mouth. A little mustard." Ready for some controversy? I can actually understand the factions of people like those in the PETA organization when they raise hell about any time an animal is treated cruelly. I think mistreating animals is a shameful practice and bad for one's karma to boot. When I talk about the mistreatment of animals, I'm thinking of some brute kicking a dog or beating a horse, or, say, the countless horrors enacted upon the chickens, hogs, and cattle in the meat factories that supply the bustling shit dispensaries we call fast food chains. And therein lies the problem. Fast food. For God's sake, and also the sake of Pete, if you don't respect your own body enough to keep it free of that garbage, at least please stop feeding it to your kids. Read Fast Food Nation. See the excellent documentary Food Inc. If your excuse is a lack of time, then you need to get your priorities straight. There is no part of this country where one cannot find a source of fresh organic meat and produce. I'm not talking about Whole Foods. I'm referring to farmers markets and local butchers and fishermen and women. If you can't find a source for fresh produce and eggs and or chicken, bacon and or dairy products, by Christ, become the source. What more noble pursuit than supplying your community with breakfast foods? If you want to read more about this notion by actual smart and informed writers, pick up some Michael Pollan and some Wendell Berry. I have no intention of ever ceasing to enjoy red meat. However, I firmly believe that we can choose how and where our meat is raised, and I'm all for a grass-fed, happy steer finding its way to my grill long before a factory-farmed, filthy, corn-fed lab creation. It's up to us to choose farm-to-table fare as much as possible until it becomes our society's norm once again. One of the most tried and true methods by which we humans can collect our own protein from the land is that of fishing. My family doesn't hunt, except for Uncle Terry, Aunt Mickey's hubby, who takes $1 or $2 a year, usually with a bow and arrow, and keeps us all happily in venison, jerky, and sausage. But we fish like crazy. Between the family households, we have cabins in Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Indiana. Fishing is the default vacation for the entire family. If there's a break, you can find us out on the lake. I have had the opportunity over the years to take some assorted friends on these Offerman Roberts family fishing trips, and nothing gives me more pleasure than teaching them to clean their own fish. Of course, it's unpleasant in comparison to being served a delicious white fillet of sole in a butter sauce with capers, but every one of my students has expressed a primitive satisfaction in the knowledge that they can harvest their own meat from a lake or river, should the shit ever really go down. I admire my uncle for his hunting discipline because he doesn't do it for the fun of killing an animal, and he doesn't do it wastefully. It's simply a choice to fulfill some of his family's grocery needs in the larder of the forest rather than the Albertsons. Among the other advantages of harvesting this meat himself, Uncle Terry is keeping himself from getting soft. We may hear more on that topic a bit further into these woods. Everybody knows, but many deny, that eating red meat gives one character. Strength, stamina, stick-to-itiveness, constitution, not to mention a healthful, glowing pelt. But take a seat for a second. Listen, I eat salad. How's that for a punch in the nuts, ladies? What's more, as I sit recording this in a West Hollywood studio, I just now ate a bowl of oatmeal. That's right, because I'm a real human animal, not a television character. You see, despite the beautifully Ron Swanson-like notion that one should exist solely on beef, pork, and wild game, the reality remains that our bodies need more varied foodstuffs that facilitate health and digestive functions, but you don't have to like it. I eat a bunch of spinach, but only to clean out my pipes to make room for more ribs, fool. I will submit to fruit and zucchini, yes, with gusto, so that my steak-eating machine will continue to masticate delicious charred flesh at an optimal running speed. By consuming kale, I am buying myself bonus years of life during which I can eat a shit ton more delicious meat. You don't put oil in your truck because it tastes good. You do it so your truck can continue burning sweet gasoline and hauling a manly payload. Chapter 2. Hail Mary, Full of Beans. My family was and still is very involved in St. Mary's Catholic Church in Manuka. Now let's get off on the right foot about religion, especially Christianity and the Bible. I generally think that organized religion has a lot of great attributes, and I think the Bible is largely an amazing and beautiful book of fictional stories from which we can glean the most wholesome lessons about how to treat one another decently. I'll have some rather different-seeming opinions later in the book. These opinions have not to do with Christians in general, but rather with ways that I believe people misuse Christianity in modern society, or ways in which people in our democratic government try to use a religious text to influence legislation. I disagree with these specific notions, and we'll talk about that in a bit. But for now, I'll say that growing up as a contributing cog in the clockwork of St. Mary's had many excellent benefits for me. I was an altar boy by age 8 or 9, and I quickly learned that I could make the people in the congregation, or audience, laugh into their missalettes if I were to, say, sniff the unstoppered cruet of Eucharistic wine and deliver an unpleasant review of its bouquet with a wrinkling of the nose, coupled with a raised eyebrow, a look I had been practicing tirelessly in school in emulation of my hero, John Belushi. My dad had a differing opinion, as you might well imagine, of my first attempt at comedy, which pretty much killed, sorry, Dad. He made it quite plain that he was not interested in any further display of opinion on my part from the altar. Thus, my surreptitious cultivation of the deadpan style was born. From the Catholic proscenium, I had to find a way to entertain my loyal following of cousins and friends whilst remaining undetected by those joyless adults. I mean, come on, who doesn't want a good laugh in the middle of boring old church? My family went to church every Sunday. There was no discussion or vote, sometimes there were tears, Our hair was cut regularly and without mercy so as to appear presentable in church, and you can bet your fanny we wore our Sunday clothes. Little sister Carrie, our only blonde, was allowed to grow her locks long, and she is still the prettiest of us, as well as the finest at belching, beating out older sis Lori by the merest decibel. Church was where the community would countenance and then assess one another on a weekly basis to make sure we were all well-scrubbed, well-clad, and well-barbered. When I began serving Mass as an altar boy, the priest was Monsignor Seidel, an old-school, and just plain old, venerated frog of a man. Great guy, just looked a bit amphibious. Things felt very institutional on his watch. It was easy to understand that our diocese, like a Catholic precinct if NYPD Blue was about church, was directly connected through an ever-ascending chain of command to Rome and the Vatican. There were 10 of us altar boys manning a strict schedule, serving in different permutations of 3 altar boys at a time. We'd cover a Mass on Saturday evening and 3 more on Sunday morning, in addition to the baptisms and funerals and weddings that peppered the calendar. The manning of special occasions was a highly coveted gig because they usually involved a handsome cash tip from the families. And that's what church is all about, right? The bread? As I was saying, the proceedings under Monsignor Seidel's reign were very august. The mood was very somber, with a deep sense of respect for the dogma of the Mass. And that's when I learned my trade. Handle the water and wine, hold the book, ring the bells, the whole 9 yards. Hold a strange, long-handled tray beneath the communion hosts, the body of Christ, as they traveled from the priest's chalice to the mouth of the believer. I definitely enjoyed the theatricality and ceremony of the Catholic Mass. The best thing the altar boys got to do was ring the handbells. The servers would jockey for position to be the guy who rang the bells. Sometimes one guy would ring the bells first and then hand them over so a second server could get a taste of the good stuff. It kind of tells you all you need to know about church if 3 seconds of bell clanging is the high point of the action. Somewhere around my 12th or 13th year, Monsignor Seidel retired and a new priest, Father Tony, came. Father Tony was a fashion plate by comparison, whom I remember as seeming very Rat Pack. He was very Italian and an urbane city guy. He had cool horn rims and a panache that was not of our small town. I was a fan, and I learned the feeling was mutual when he graduated me from altar boy to the role of the lector, a position usually assayed by an older person. I would recite the gospel readings before his sermon, and that was really where I commenced to having an effect on an audience for the first time. I did care about the quality of the storytelling in my readings, and I sincerely wanted to impart the day's lesson and help get it across, but at the same time, I would maybe just stress certain words that I thought were interesting, such as, "Jesus did come hard upon Lake Genesaret." I would linger ever so slightly upon words and phrases that I found humorous, so that my cousin Ryan and 6 other friends would crack up, but no one else had any idea I was being hilarious. As discussed, I believe it's where I first learned to hone the art of dry humor. I became somewhat the hired hand of St. Mary's. I was the go-to kid, hired to cut the grass and stock the shelves and wax the pews. My cousin Ryan played the trumpet, and I played the saxophone, so we also started making some extra bread on the side by playing weddings and such. Again, church seemed pretty cool with a couple of sweet Alexander Hamiltons in my pocket. The mystical conversion that occurs in every Catholic Mass, in which the blood and body of Jesus Christ, our Lord, become wine and inexplicably little round white bread wafers, respectively, is known as transubstantiation. Turning my devotion to the church into cash seemed like a much more appealing transformation. I performed a lot of yard work for Father Tony. He had a house on the Kankakee River an hour or so south, and he would take Ryan and me to the river to perform yard labor, split firewood and whatnot, and then take us water skiing behind his boat. It's not a euphemism. I am sincerely grateful for that time, in which our priest appeared on stage, as it were, Perhaps as one of the more exciting characters in our community, what with a speedboat and fancy eyeglasses. We had our version of Sunday school called catechism. It was terrible, just the worst. By the time you're 7 or 8 years old, you get it. I understood the stories of Jesus and his disciples and the values I was expected to glean thereof. Now, there are things I like just fine about church, and I don't just mean making money. The notion of getting together as a community to remind ourselves why we shouldn't behave like animals is a fucking great idea. Church was also the place to get a look at all of the young ladies and the other families, the better to determine whose chests you'd like to target with your clumsy fumblings. It's all the other shitty parts, like when priests tell you who to vote for in a presidential race because they're personally opposed to a woman's right to choose, that irk me. That's where church crosses my line. When the clergy get too big for their britches, they take these wonderfully benevolent writings from the Bible and crumble their intended integrity by slathering them with human nature. I remember sitting in my seat at the far stage right side of the altar while the congregation would slog through group recitations like the Nicene Creed. We believe in one God, the Father, the Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, of all that is seen and unseen, in the most Pavlovian way. The cultish, soulless tone in which this group of 200 people would repeat this creed of purpose, meant to resonate like a mission statement, lent no fervor to nor even indicated any apparent awareness of what they were saying. Now we say this part, we get the talking over with so I can get home to the football game. One Sunday in my mid-teens, I really heard them droning on, and I found it quite upsetting. I thought, listen to what you're saying. You're repeating this supposed profession of your faith, and I'll wager you literally couldn't tell me what the fuck you're talking about right now. The words of the creed, as well as this whole notion, are so profound. To re-up your faith week in and week out, but the meaning is utterly lost on you. This is not working. This mass is not working for these people. I'm not interested in taking part in this because it doesn't seem to be working. In eighth grade, the church community was all abuzz because they were bringing in this hotshot nun, Sister Jesuina, to teach our catechism class. It was very exciting and potentially scandalous because the word was she had unorthodox teaching methods, which included playing us the Billy Joel song, Only the Good Die Young, and explaining that while this popular music was catchy, sure, it disguised a nefarious satanic message. You might think he sounds logical and modern, but Virginia, he's just trying to get into your pants and knock you up. And, 100 times better than even Billy Joel, she also brought in Playboy and Penthouse magazines. What? Penthouse shows pink in the vernacular of porn mags. Playboy, by comparison, does not show pink. Penthouse will teach you more about the biology of a lady's privates. But believe it or not, she brought in porn magazines to church class, and she passed them around. All of us boys thought, you are easily the greatest fucking nun I have ever remotely encountered, but you're also a complete moron if you think you're going to turn us teenage boys in the throes of puberty off to porn by showing us this nice lady's utterly amazing bush. Holy Lamb of God, I'll stay at this church class all day long. It just dawned on me, as I am speaking this, that all of these people simply didn't have their shit together, which is understandable since their task was not and is not easy, trying to keep this eldritch, tired dogma relevant for the youth of modern society. All things considered, I really had an amazing time at St. Mary's, despite the religious parts. The good part about the church for me was the people and the playboys. Father Tony gave me the opportunity to get up in front of people to begin to fine-tune my subliminal messaging, and he nurtured, even unwittingly, my need to perform. In high school, when I figured out that I would be attending theater school to pursue stage acting, he said to me, "I understand this decision, and I think it's something you might have a shot at. I just want you to be careful, because in the world of show business, there's going to be a lot of drugs and a lot of sex. There's going to be a lot of temptation." And I said, "Yes, thank you." Horse sense is greater than the Bible. The Holy Bible. This good book is a book of fairy tales.
What?
Yes, folks, for a fairy tale, by definition, is a fictional story that contains some sort of supernatural creature or occurrence. The Bible is chock full of both. I don't feel the need to quibble about Old Testament or New, the Gnostics, or any of that crap. My issue is with the exploitation of the entire Bible. Now, some of the more prevalent supernatural elements in the Bible we are all pretty familiar with. An all-powerful deity called God, and his charismatic boy, Jesus, who has some superpowers like self-resurrection, and some cool action like the Wonder Twins turning sticks into snakes and greatly multiplying bread loaves and fish sticks until history's first all-you-can-eat experience was invented. Plus a burning bush, a cool sea that has a secret hallway that opens and closes for you depending on your race and religion, and your usual mountebank sleights of hand in revival settings, healings, etc. Magics. This book of fairy tales has proven to yield a wealth of lessons for people who study it. You know the form, it's old-school cautionary tale. Jehidicus did walk him to the woodpile after dark to fetch some wood, so that the women about the place could cook for him and the men some whey cakes, so long as the women be clean and their flowers be not upon them, which would be super gross. Because of the darkness, Jehidicus did notice not the woodchuck resting on the woodpile until it did bite of his hand flesh. When Jesus heard tell of this in the marketplace, he did laugh his ass off. And then Jesus spake unto the peoples, "Gather ye not your fire from the darkness, but instead seek it in the light of day." Then Jesus said to his apostle Steve, "Steve," he said, "go thee to the woodpile and put the woodchuck to death, taking care that it not nibble at thy hand." There are at least 27 good metaphorical ways to interpret this famous scripture from the Book of Nick, and they're all sound. Father, by all means, teach me philosophical methods based upon them. I love philosophy. I love to learn creative ways of viewing the world and mankind's various dilemmas and triumphs. Just don't fucking tell me we should kill all the woodchucks because the Bible says so. That's it. That's all I'm driving at. It's a book of stories that should be treated as suggestions. It is not a book of rules for the citizens of the United States of America. To say that one more time, the Bible is not a book of rules for the citizens of the United States of America. A step further, creationism. If you want to go in so deep as to ignore all of the advances and hard facts that science and learning have provided us in the field of biological evolution, and instead profess that the creation story, written by men from their holy visions, about how the Christian deity spinning the world together out of the void in the magic of Genesis describes the true origin of the universe, that is your business. Terrific. It's a cool story, don't get me wrong. I love magic. Check out Madeline L'Engle's A Wrinkle in Time, which won a Newbery Medal. For the record, I don't believe the Book of Genesis ever won one of those. You and your fellow creationists profess belief in a magical story. You are welcome to do so. Sing and chant, and eat crackers and drink wine that you claim are magically infused with the blood and flesh of your church's original grand wizard, the Prince of Peace. I personally think that's just a touch squirrely, but that's your business, not mine. You will not be punished for those beliefs in our nation of individual freedoms. But I do think the vast majority of your fellow Americans would appreciate it, kind creationists, if you silly motherfuckers would keep that bullshit out of our schools. Your preferred fairy tales have no place in a children's classroom or textbook that professes to be teaching our youngsters what is real. Jesus Christ, it's irrefutably un-American, people. Let's take a brief listen to Thomas Jefferson's letter of 1802 to the Danbury Baptist Association. In his letter making reference to the First Amendment to the United States Constitution, Jefferson writes, "Believing with you that religion is a matter which lies solely between man and his God, that he owes account to none other for his faith or his worship, that the legitimate powers of government reach actions only and not opinions, I contemplate with sovereign reverence that act of the whole American people which declared that their legislature should make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, thus building a wall of separation between church and state." Okay, all right, I thought I had coined the phrase separation of church and state, but apparently this periwigged joker, this Jefferson, got there before I did. Why haven't we the people remembered it? It seems like a cool idea. The First Amendment, by the way, states that, quote, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof," end quote. Now, what does all of this terribly written gobbledygook mean? I'm glad you asked. The first thing I'll point out is Jefferson's correct assertion that the legitimate powers of government reach actions only and not opinions. Check it. If you subscribe to a group that worships a piece of fictional writing, say, I don't know, the Holy Bible, then that is your business. Go for it. Create ceremonies full of symbolic magic tricks involving the transformation of a long-dead spirit's body and blood into a cracker and a sip of wine. Sing songs about it. Rejoice at the magic. In America, you may do so with absolute impunity. However, should you try to bring your beliefs into a public argument of any sort, those beliefs can hold no water. Here's why. As discussed earlier in this book, the stories of the Christian God and all of his purported works are merely a collection of stories. And if you choose to have faith in the truth of those stories, regardless of right or wrong, your belief that they are true is your opinion. You are welcome to it. Secondly, the First Amendment is telling us that there shall be no laws favoring any churches, and also no laws prohibiting whatever you might want to think about or preach in your respective churches. Change the cracker to a pickle. You can. It's a First Amendment right. I love my country. Holy shit, do I love America. In many ways, it is the glorious result of some very open-minded thinking on the parts of our forefathers and the ladies advising them a couple of centuries ago. But that right there's the rub, y'all. We're a group of human beings, which means we can never be done trying to improve ourselves, and by default, our systems, including our government. Now, here's the deal. Invoking the Bible in any public school or at any government function? Un-American. Making a witness in a court of law place his or her hand on the Bible? Un-American. Disputing legislation based upon what it says in your holy book? Not patriotic. Where does this holy book come from, after all? Let's imagine a conversation. So, Father Mark, why should we do what the Bible says? Well, Nick, that's easy. It's because it's the Word of God. God? Yes, God the Father, the creator of heaven and earth, of all that is seen and unseen. That's trippy. It is.
So, God wrote the Bible?
Well, in a manner of speaking. God spoke to the men who wrote the Bible and told them what to write, and so I guess...
So the Bible was ghostwritten.
Well, Nick, it's a little more sacred than that.
How so, Father? All dudes, right?
Excuse me?
Only men, no female ghost scribes, correct?
Well, yes, that is so.
Okay, does God prefer men to women? Are men smarter at Bible stuff?
No. It's just, well, there weren't really even women who could write in the time of the scribes. It was a different time.
Okay. Seems a little thin. Anyway, so here's what I can't seem to puzzle out, Padre. If these guys wrote the Bible chapters based on their divine visions or what have you, what evidence can you show me that they didn't just make it up? I'll be honest, when you invite me to your church and gently suggest that I tithe 10% of my income to this sort of Bible club, it makes me wonder a bit. You know, was 10% the number God suggested? Is there a religion where gratuity is included?
Nick, I'm glad you asked me that, because that question is really the linchpin of our faith. There is absolutely no proof. How could there be? That these scribes were given supernatural messages from a power greater than anything they could know. It actually sounds pretty crazy when I say it like that.
You see?
Well, no, Nick, but that's what I was saying. It is because we believe in this truth that we can build our entire church upon faith.
Okay, Father, given that statement, isn't it a little generous to refer to that information as the truth?
Well, not to us. We are believers. In John 14:6, Jesus says, "I am the way, the truth, and the life."
Again, the proof you're citing, Father, is that a man spoke to another guy and he then reported it. You really trust the reporter? Have you seen TMZ?
Nick, the Bible, as a collection of holy texts handed down directly as the Word of God, has to be considered above the uncertain scrutiny of we mortals.
Wow. Okay, I get that. But to the rest of us Americans who aren't believers in your ambitious claim that these writings are actually true, using the definition of true that involves factual reality, can you see how it would seem inappropriate to us for followers of your book of stories to attempt to bring their faithful opinions to bear on real-world issues like legal policy and public programs and school curricula?
You sound like you're writing a book, my friend.
It's a humorous book, which is sweet. It means no research. Are you avoiding my question?
No, I'm sorry. The answer to your question can be found in the Bible.
But that's what I'm saying. For all of us who don't want to adhere to the stories upon which your religion is founded, isn't it fair to ask you to leave it at church? How would you feel if all the Buddhists began insisting that some Zen koans were recited every morning before class in our public schools? I think what the First Amendment is driving at is simply that our American policy ensures a fair shake to all citizens, to consider and choose whatever religion, if any, they wish to take part in. If we pray to the Christian God in schools, we offend the Muslims and the Buddhists and the Hindus and certainly the subgeniuses and countless others. If we sing our fealty to Krishna before Major League Baseball games, then the Hindus might be tickled, but again, everybody else will get their panties in a bundle. Ostensibly, the goal of any religion is to improve the character, the moral fiber of its adherents. We are all just seeking to become more decent, right? Why not, then, engage in these improvements whilst in private, at home or at the denominational gathering place of our choosing, bolstering our individual virtues with solid consistency, then simply bring that improved character to bear upon public issues? As in, wow, Senator Torgelman, you make really honorable decisions. How do you do it? Senator Torgelman may then pound his heart twice with his fist, kiss two fingers, and point to the heavens. Or he may just as likely press his palms together and bow, uttering namaste. Or even lightly caress the war hammer hanging from his belt and declare clearly, "Praise Odin."
Okay, Nick, it smells bad in this truck.
Sorry, Father. Pulled pork.
Well, do you mind if I take off?
Be my guest.
Door handle won't open.
Psych.
Hilarious, Nick. Hey, thanks for the weed.
Thanks for the money, Dad. I weep and stare at my reflection in the rain-jeweled windshield. I'm going to speak this next part in reverb to try to make it as clear as possible. If you read the Bible and go to church or subscribe to any other religion, that is fine with me. I like nice people, and if you are endeavoring to be one, I say, great. I, too, am endeavoring to be a nice person. The thing that makes me mad is when a person suggests that I cannot be a nice person or live a life of goodness without reading the Bible and attending church. To sum up, churchgoers, fine and dandy. Those who try to force it on me and my fellow Americans, assholes. Areas in which they try to force it on us, premarital sex abstention, abortion laws, birth control, gay marriage. The fact that creationism can even be a conversation is a goddamn shame and blight upon our nation's character. Jesus was a great and wise man, we get it. His teachings are an excellent set of guidelines by which to conduct oneself. Copy that. But you don't get to bring your church book into the city, county, state, or national policy discussion. Put that shit away. Why? Because it's simply not fair. It's not how we play in the old U.S. of A. Muslims are not slinging their shibboleths down on the congressmen or women's desks. Nor are they the insane freaks committing violence upon abortion clinics shouting slogans from the Torah. The Quran is full of wisdom. The Tao Te Ching is an amazing resource of life lessons. Why do I have to be having this argument in this day and age? For fuck's sake, you use your religious or not writing of choice at home, or in a place where people gather to imbibe your religion of choice. Hopefully, this practice teaches you decency, common sense, and goodwill toward your fellow men and women. Then, you take that decency and put it to good use when drafting legal policy. Leave your church out of it. If I were to coin a phrase, I don't know, I might suggest a separation of church and state, just like old Thomas Jefferson did. Time to re-up that shit. Forgive my eloquence.